Hey guys, and welcome back to Stories in the Dark. It's been a hot freaking minute. Sorry, but anyways, sorry for the incredibly spacious times between each episode or season. Life just gets getting in the hold. Anyway, so I decided that I was going to do a longer case this time so I can make it up to you guys. And I've had a lot of people ask me which case I was going to do, and I kept that a secret. So today we're going to find out finally what case it is that I'm hoping is going to blow y'all away like it's blown me away. Now, the case we're going to be covering is fairly known, I won't lie. Some people know about this case and others are not really like familiar, but it's okay because we're going to sit down today and we are going to be talking about the one and only Amelia Earhart. Now, this may be a two-parter or a three-parter. I'm not sure yet, but I do know for a fact that it's going to be a long one. Okay. So, I'm going to give you some information like I've done in previous videos, and then I'll head on to the case. So, Amelia Earhart was born Amelia Mary Earhart on July 24th, 1897 in Atchison's, Kansas. She disappeared at the age of 39 on July 2nd, 1937, in the Pacific Ocean en route to Howland Island from Ley, New Guinea. On January 5th, 1939, Amelia Earhart, at the age of 41, was declared dead in Astatina. She is known for many early avitation records, including first woman to fly solo across the Atlantic Ocean. Her spouse was George P. Putnam. They got married in 1931. And now we're going to go into her story. Amelia Mary Earhart, born July 24th, 1897, disappeared July 2nd. 1937, declared dead January 5th, 1939. She was an American aviation pioneer and author. Earhart was the first female avatar to fly solo across the Atlantic Ocean. She set many other records, wrote best-selling books and her flying experiences, and was instrumental in the formation of the 99s, an organization for female pilots. Born in Kansas, wow. Earhart developed a passion for adventure at a young age, steadily gaining flying experience from her 20s. In 1928, Amelia Earhart became the first female passenger to cross the Atlantic by airplane, accompanying pilot Wilmer Stultz, for which she achieved celebrity status. In 1932, piloting a Lockheed Vega 5B, Earhart made a non-stop solo transatlantic flight, becoming the first woman to achieve such a feat. She received the United States Distinguished Flying Cross for this accomplishment. In 1935, Earhart became a visiting facility faculty member at Purdue University as an advisor to aeronautical engineering and a career counselor to women students. She was also a member of the National Women's Party and an early supporter of the Equal Rights Amendment. Good for you, girl. During an attempt at becoming the first female to complete a Kermanevital flight of Globe in 1937 in a Peru-founded Lockheed Model 10E Electra, Earhart and navigator Fred Noonan disappeared over the Central Pacific Ocean near Howard Island. The two were last seen in Le Nugina on July 2, 1937, on the last land stop before Howland Island and one of their final legs of the flight. Nearly 1 year and 6 months after she and Noonan disappeared, Earhart was officially declared dead. Investigation and significant public interest in their disappearance still continue over 80 years later. Earhart was the daughter of Samuel Edwin Stanton Earhart and Amelia Amy Nee Otis. She was born in Atchison, Arkansas, in the home of her maternal grandfather, Alfred Ginnon Otis, who was a former federal judge. The president of the Atchison Savings Bank and a leading citizen in the town. Amelia was the second child of the marriage after an infant was stillborn in August 1896. She was of a part German descent. Alfred Otis had not initially favored the marriage and was not satisfied with Edwin's progress as a lawyer. According to family custom, Earhart was named after her two grandmothers, Amelia Josephine Harris and Mary Wells Patton. From an early age, Amelia was the ringleader with her sister Grace, 2 years her junior, acted as the doubtful follower. Amelia was nicknamed Mealy, or sometimes Millie, and Grace was named Pidge. Both girls continued to answer to their childhood nicknames well into adulthood. Their upbringing was unconventional, as Amy Earhart did not believe in raising her children to be nice little girls. But their paternal grandmother disapproved of the bloomers they were. And although Earhart liked the freedom of movement they provided, she was sensitive to the fact that the neighborhood girls wore dresses. A spirit of adventure seemed to abide in Earhart's children, with the pair setting off daily to explore their neighborhood. As a child, Amelia spent long hours playing with sister Pidge, climbing trees, hunting rats with a rifle, and belly slamming her sled downhill. Although the love of the outdoors and rough and tumble play was common to many youngsters, some biographers have characterized the young Earhart as a tomboy. The girls kept worms, moths, and a tree toad. Oh, that's so cute. In a growing collection gathered in their outings. In 1904, with the help of her uncle, Amelia cobbled together a homemade ramp, fashioned after a roller coaster she had seen on a trip to St. Louis, and secured the ramp to the roof of the family tool shed. Earhart's well-documented first flight ended dramatically. She emerged from the broken wooden box that had served as a sled with a bruised lip, torn dress, and a sensation of exhilaration. She claimed, "Oh, Pidge, it's just like flying." Although there had been some missteps in Edwin Earhart's career up to that point. In 1907, his job as a claims officer for the Rock Island Railroad led to transfer to Des Moines, Iowa. The next year, at the age of 10, Earhart saw her first aircraft at the Iowa State Fair in Des Moines. Her father tried to interest his daughters in taking a flight. One look at the rickety flivver was enough for Earhart, who promptly asked if they could go back to the merry-go-round. She later described the airplane as a thing of rusty wire and wood and not at all interesting. Well, okay. Sister Amelia and Muriel, who went by her middle name from her teens on, remained with their grandparents in Atchison's while their parents moved into new, smaller quarters in Des Moines. During this period, the Earhart girls received homeschooling from their mother and governess. Amelia later recounted that she was exceedingly fond of reading and spent countless hours in the large family library. In 1909, when the family was finally reunited, the Earhart children were enrolled in public school for the first time, and Amelia, 12, entered 7th grade. While the family's finances seemingly improved with the acquisition of a new house and even the hiring of two servants, it soon became apparent that Edwin was an alcoholic. 5 years later, in 1914, he was forced to retire, and although he attempted to rehabilitate himself through treatment, he never sustained at the Rock Island Railroad. At about this time, Earhart's grandmother, Amelia Otis, died suddenly, leaving a substantial estate that placed her daughter's share in a trust, fearing that Edwin's drinking would drain the funds. The Otis house was auctioned along with all of its contents. Earhart was broken and later described it as the end of her childhood. In 1915, after a long search, Earhart's father found work as a clerk at the Great Northern Railway in St. Paul, Minnesota, where Earhart entered Central High School as a junior. Edwin applied for a transfer to Springfield, Missouri in 1915, but the current claims offer considered his retirement and demanded his job back, leaving the elder Earhart with nowhere to go. Facing another calamitous move, Amy Earhart took her children to Chicago, where they lived with friends. Earhart made an unusual condition in the choice of her next schooling. She canvassed nearby high schools in Chicago to find the best science program. She rejected the high school near her home when she complained that the chemistry lab was just like a kitchen sink. She eventually enrolled in Hyde Park High School, but spent a miserable semester where a yearbook caption captured the essence of her unhappiness. A.E., the girl in brown who walks alone. Earhart graduated from Chicago's Hyde Park High School in 1916. Throughout her troubled childhood, she had continued to aspire up to a future career. She kept a scrapbook of newspaper clippings about successful women in predominantly male-oriented fields, including film direction and production, law, advertising, management, and mechanical engineering. She began junior college at Aunt School in Rydell, Pennsylvania, but did not complete her program. During Christmas vacation in 1917, Earhart visited her sister in Toronto. World War I had been raging, and Earhart saw the returning wounded soldiers. After receiving training as a nurse's aide from Red Cross, she began to work with the Voluntary Aid Detachment at Spadina Military Hospital. Her duties included preparing food in the kitchen for patients with special diets and handing out prescription medication in the hospital's dispensary. The Spanish Flu Pandemic of 1918. When the 1918 Spanish Flu Pandemic reached Toronto, Earhart was engaged in arduous nursing duties that included night shifts at the Spadina Military Hospital. She became a patient herself, suffering from pneumonia and maxillary sinusitis. She was hospitalized in early November 8, 1918, owing to pneumonia, and discharged in December 1918, about 2 months after the illness had started. Her sinus-related symptoms were pain and pressure around one eye and copious mucus drainage. She also did competitive flying. Although Earhart had gained fame for her transatlantic flight, she endeavored to set an untarnished record for her own. Shortly after her return, piloting Avion 7083, she set off on her first solo flight that occurred just as her name was coming into the national spotlight. She moved from New York to California while Earhart was away on a speaking tour in late November 1934. A fire had broke out at the Putnam residence in Rye, destroying many family treasures and Earhart's personal mementos. He already sold his interest in the New York-based publishing company to his cousin. Following the fire, the couple decided to move to the West Coast, where Putnam took up his new position as head of the editorial board of Paramount Pictures in North Hollywood. Wow. On March 17th, 1937, Earhart and her crew flew the first leg from Oakland, California to Honolulu, Hawaii. In addition to Earhart and Noonan, Mary Manning and Mance, who was acting as Earhart's technical advisor, were on board. Due to lubrication and galling problems with the propeller hubs, variable pitch mechanisms the aircraft needed servicing in Hawaii. Ultimately, the Electra ended up at the United States Navy's Luke Field on Ford Island in Pearl Harbor. The flight resumed 3 days later from Luke Field with Earhart, Noonan, and Manning on board. The next destination was Howard Island, a small island in the Pacific. Manning, the only skilled radio operator, had made arrangements to use radio direction finding to home into the island. The flight never left Luke Field. Please wait for a commercial that is not sponsored. Excuse me, YouTube. Our new liquid conditioner with Mylar technology. It instantly resurfaces hair with no way down. Hair is shinier. New Dream Lights Wonder Water by L'Oreal Paris. Well worth it. Yeah. Sorry about that, guys. During the takeoff run, there was an uncontrolled ground loop. The forward landing gear collapsed. Both propellers hit the ground. The plane skidded on its belly, and portion of the runway was damaged. The cause of the ground loop is controversial. Some witnesses at Luke Field, including the Associated Press journalist, said they saw a tire blow. Earhart thought either the Electra's right tire had blown and or the right landing gear had collapsed. Some sources, including Mance, cited pilot error. With the aircraft severely damaged, the flight was canceled and called off, and the aircraft was shipped by sea to the Lockheed Burbank facility for repairs. Manning, having taken a leave of absence to do the flight, felt that there had been too many problems and delays. He ended his association with the trip, leaving only Earhart and Noonan. Neither of them were skilled radio operators. The second flight. While the Electra was being prepared, Earhart and Putnam secured additional funds and prepared for a second attempt, this time flying west to east. The second attempt began with an unpublicized flight from Oakland to Miami, Florida. And after arriving there, Earhart publicly announced her plans to circumnavigate the globe. The flight's opposite direction was partly the result of changes in globe wind and weather patterns along the planned route since the earlier attempt. On the second flight, Fred Noonan and Earhart's only crew member. The pair departed Miami on June 1st, and the numerous stops in South America, Africa, the Indian subcontinent, and Southeast Asia arrived at Ley, New Guinea on June 29, 1937. At this stage, about 22,000 miles of their journey had been completed. The remaining 7,000 miles would be over the Pacific. On July 2, 1937, midnight GMT, Earhart and Noonan took off from Ley Airfield in the heavily loaded Electra. Their intended destination was Howland Island. A flat sliver of land 6,500 feet long and 1,600 feet wide, 10 feet high, and 2,556 miles away. The aircraft departed Ley with about 1,100 gallons of gasoline. In March 1937, Kelly Johnson had recommended engine and altitude settings for Electra. One of the recommended scheduled was 2050 inches 28.5, Cambridge 0.7, fuel consumption not applicable, hours not applicable, fuel of gas 40 plus maybe, and octane is 100. That was just the first one. Earhart used part of the above schedules, which I read, for the Oakland to Honolulu leg for the first world flight attempt. Johnson estimated that 900 gallons of fuel would provide 40% more range than required for that leg. Using 900 gallons was 250 gallons less than the Electra's maximum fuel tank capacity. That meant a weight savings of 1,500 pounds. So Earhart included Mance as a passenger on that leg. The Oakland to Honolulu leg had Earhart, Noonan, Manning, and Mance on board. The flight from Oakland to Honolulu took 16 hours. The Electra also loaded 900 gallons of fuel for the shorter Honolulu to Howland leg. With only Earhart, Noonan, and Manning on board, but the airplane crashed on takeoff. The crash ended the first world flight attempt. At around 3 p.m. Ley time, Earhart reported her altitude as 1,000 feet, but that would reduce altitude due to thick clouds. Around 5 p.m., Earhart reported her altitude as 7,000 feet. 700 feet, and sped at 150 knots. That doesn't make sense. Why would... What? Okay. Their last known position near was the Nukumanu Islands, about 800 miles into the flight. During the flight, Noonan may have been able to do some celestial navigation to determine his position. The plane would cross the international dateline during the flight. Failing to account for the dateline would account for a 1 degree or 60 mile position error. During Earhart and Noonan's approach to Howland Island, the Itasca received strong and clear voice transmissions from Earhart identifying as KHAQQ, but she apparently was unable to hear voice transmissions from the ship. Signals from the ship would also be used for direction finding, implying that the aircraft's direction finder was also not functional. The first calls, routine reports stating the weather as cloudy and overcast, were received at 2:45 and just before 5 a.m. on July 2nd. These calls were broken up by static, but at this point, the aircraft would have been a long distance from Howland. At 6:14 a.m., another call was received stating the aircraft was within 200 miles and requested that the ship use its direction finder to provide a bearing for the aircraft. Amelia began whistling into the microphone to provide a continual signal for them to home in on. It was at this point that the radio operators on the Itasca realized that their RDF system could not tune in to the aircraft's 3105 KHZ frequency. Radio man Leo Bellarts later commented that he was sitting there sweating blood because I couldn't do a darn thing about it. A similar call asking for a bearing was received at 6:45 a.m. when Earhart estimated they were 100 miles out. An Itasca radio log position 1 at 7:30 to 7:40 a.m. states, Earhart on NW says running out of gas, only half hour left, can't hear us at all. We hear her and are sending on 3105 ES 500, same the constantly. Another radio log position 2 at 7:42 a.m. states, Amelia Earhart's plane, cling Itasca, we must be on you but can't see you, but gas is running low, been unable to reach you by radio, we're flying at 1,000 feet. Earhart 7:58 a.m. transmission said she couldn't hear the Itasca and asked them to send voice signals so she could try to take a radio bearing. The transmission was reported by Itasca and the loudest possible signal indicating Earhart and Noon were in the immediate area. They couldn't send voice at the frequency she asked for, so a Morse code signal was sent instead. Earhart acknowledged receiving these, but said she was unable to determine their direction. In her last known transmission at 8:43 a.m., Earhart broadcasts, we are on line 157337. We will repeat this message. We will repeat this on 6210 Kylo sites. Wait. However, a few moments later, she was back on the same frequency with a transmission that was logged as questionable. We are running on the line north and south. Earhart's transmission seemed to indicate she and Noonan believed that they had reached Howland's charted position, which was incorrect, but about 5 nautical miles. The Itasca used her oil-fired boilers to generate smoke for a period of time, but the filers apparently did not see it. The many scattered clouds in the area around Howland Island have also been cited as a problem. Their dark shadows on the ocean surface may have been almost indistinguishable from the island's subdued and very flat profile. Whether any post-lost radio signals were received from Earhart and Noonan remains unclear. If transmissions were received from the Electra, most of it, not all, were weak and hopelessly garbled. Earhart's voice transmissions to Howard were on 3105 KHZ, a frequency restricted to the U.S. by the FCC to aviation use. This frequency was thought to be not fit for the broadcasts over great distance. When Earhart was at cruising altitude and midway between Ley and Howland, over 1,000 miles from each other, neither station heard her scheduled transmission at 0815 GCT. Moreover, the 50-watt transmitter used by Earhart was attached to a less than optimum length V-type antenna. The last voice transmitted received on Howard Island from Earhart indicated she and Noonan were flying along a line of position running north to south on 157.337 degrees, which Noonan would have calculated and drawn on a chart as passing through Howland. After all contact was lost with Howland Island, attempts were made to reach the flyers by both voice and Morse code transmission. Operators across the Pacific and the United States may have heard signals from the downed Electra, but these were unintelligible or weak. Some of the same reports of transmission were later determined to be hoaxed, by others were deemed authentic. Bearings taken by Pan American Airways station suggested signals originating from several locations, including Gardner Island. It was noted at the time that if these signals were from Earhart and Noonan, they must have been on land with the aircraft, since water would have otherwise shorted out the electrical system. Spordiak signals were reported for 4 or 5 days after the disappearance, but none yielded any understandable information. The captain of USS Colorado later said, "There was no doubt many stations were calling the Earhart plane on the plane's frequency, some by voice and others by signal. All of these added to the confusion and doubtfulness of the authenticity of the reports." Beginning approximately after 1 hour after Earhart's last message, the USCGC Itasca undertook an ultimately unsuccessful search north and west of Howland Island based on initial assumptions about transmissions from the aircraft. The United States Navy soon joined the search and over a period of 3 days sent available researchers to the area in the vicinity of Howard Island. The initial search by the Itasca involved running up the 157 to 337 line of position to the north northwest from Howland Island. The Itasca then searched the area of the immediate northeast of the island corresponding to the area, yet wider than the area searched for the to the northwest. Based on bearings of several supposed Earhart radio transmissions, some of the search efforts were directed to a specific position on the line, on a line of 281 degrees, approximately northwest from Howland Island, without evidence of the flyers. 4 days after Earhart's last verified radio transmission on July 6, 1937, the captain of the battleship Colorado received orders from the commandant Norteen Naval District to take over all naval and Coast Guard's units to coordinate search efforts. Later search efforts were directed to the Phoenix Islands, south of Howland Island. A week after the disappearance, naval aircraft from the Colorado flew over several islands in the group, including Gardner Island, now called Nukumarawo, which had been uninhabited for over 40 years. The subsequent report on Gardner read, "Here signs of recent habitation were clearly visible, but repeated circling and zooming failed to elicit any answering wave from possible inhabitants, and it was finally taken for granted that none were there. At the western end of the island, a tramper steamer of about 4,000 tons lay high and almost dry, head onto the coral beach with her back broken in two places. The lagoon at Garner looked significantly deep and certainly large enough to fit a seaplane or even an airboat would have been landed on or take off in any direction with little, if any, difficulty. Given a chance, it is believed that Miss Earhart could have landed her aircraft in this lagoon and swum or waded ashore. There are also found that Garner's shape and size, as recorded on charts, were wholly inaccurate. Other Navy search efforts were again directed north, west, and southwest of Helen Island, based on the possibility the Electra had ditched in the ocean, was afloat, or that the aviators were in the emergency raft. There had been considerable speculation on what happened to Earhart and Noonan. Most historians hold to the simple crash and sink theory, but a number of other possibilities have been proposed, including several conspiracy theories. Some have suggested that Earhart and Noonan survived and landed elsewhere, but were either never found or killed, making en route locations like Tearaway unlikely. Proposals have included the inhabited Garner Island, ...640 kilometers from the vicinity of Howland. The Japanese controlled Marshall Islands at the closest point, and the Japanese controlled Miles, controlled Northern Mariana Islands, 2,700 miles, 4,300 kilometers from Howland. So this is a crash and think series. It's going to be in part two.